Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know that early part of a roller coaster ride, right as you tip over the top of the first big hill and your stomach kind of does a little thing that makes you feel all queasy? That's what Wall Street was like on this Monday, staring down into the face of a week of unknown corporate profits. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 14th of April, the calendar says. Glad to have you with us. Grab a good firm hold of that safety bar, everybody. Make sure it's low and snug across your hips, just like it's supposed to be, because we could be in for a doozy. We're going to hear from J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, and others this week about first quarter profits. It's entirely possible it's going to be a nice, gentle ride, but we did hit a big bump early today when Wachovia posted an unexpected first quarter loss of $350 million. Most of that was the result of the bank's spectacularly poorly timed move into the mortgage business. But all the same, investors are left to wait and wonder what's coming up around the next curve. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
If you've got a stake in the stock market, it could be well worth your time to pay close attention to how things play out in the days ahead. The way that Wall Street reacts to this week's profit reports could be just as important as the numbers themselves. It may signal whether the damage from the economic downturn, the mortgage mess, and the credit crisis has now been priced into share values, or whether there's still more bloodletting ahead. Ted Weisberg is a stockbroker at Seaport Securities.
Have the stocks priced in the news? Is there more bad news out there than we have basically accounted for? And will we get the kind of clarification that will help investors make a decision based on today's news for tomorrow?
Today's bad news from Wachovia did drag other financial stocks down, but the bottom didn't fall out of the overall market, and Weisberg is hopeful that's a good sign.
You know, it's sort of like kicking a dead horse. I mean, after a while, you just don't get a reaction. That point comes for an individual stock when a stock begins to ignore the bad news of the day.
At Jefferies & Company, Chief Market Analyst Art Hogan is also sensing that even the bad news might not be having the dramatic effect it still did just a month or two ago.
What would have happened to these names 3 months ago if this news had come out versus what's happening now?
Hogan says the stock market is a compass to the future, and he's optimistic it's pointing north.
Sometime in the fourth quarter or sometime in the first half of next year, there will be a better market out there, a better economy, and I think that's what we're focusing on right now.
Stockbroker Ted Weisberg says it's just a gut feeling, but he points out that's what steers the stock market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's part of the week's earnings calendar if you want to prepare yourselves. We'll get Washington Mutual tomorrow, J.P. Morgan Wednesday, Citigroup is on Friday. I know you're wondering about Bear Stearns, not that it means anything at this point, but they announced this afternoon first quarter profits tanked 79%. This was a big weekend for the big wigs of the financial world. We're talking about the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the G7 here. They wrapped up three long days of top-level meetings yesterday. From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
About the best thing you could say about the weekend meetings is there was no public squabbling. It was easy to agree to do nothing. Economist Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic Policy Research says that's a problem.
When, you know, everyone stands up at a football game, and if you stand up by yourself, you can see, but if everybody stands up, then nobody can see. And so there's times when you need a coordinated decision.
The financial players came out of their huddle over the weekend and promptly ran off the field. They decided they would each just look after their own economies. The G7 did say it didn't want to see the dollar slide anymore, but the G7 team is missing some crucial players, China and India. Economist Moyara Rusin of the Monterey Institute of International Studies says that limits the G7's impact.
What we have is a conversation only between finance ministers and central bankers from Western Europe, North America, and Japan.
But Fred Bergsten of the Peterson Institute for International Economics says it's not clear the world would take action even if China and India were included. That's because many countries feel the U.S. is to blame for its own problems. The U.S. economy sneezed, and nobody even said Gesundheit.
When the U.S. sneeze does not lead to pneumonia or even a cold abroad, it really demonstrates a decoupling through the great expansion of trade among countries outside the United States.
Bergsten says the world hasn't been this decoupled from the U.S. economy since World War II. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You want decoupling? We got it right here. Today, the dollar gave up what little gains it made in the overnight foreign exchange markets. Traders are selling greenbacks as they continue to fret about the U.S. economy. Blockbuster might be down, but it's not quite out. The company's wanted to get its mitts on Circuit City for a while now. The faltering video chain made an offer for the floundering electronics giant a couple of weeks ago, put that bid out in the open today. And just like that, the questions started coming. Questions like, how's that going to work exactly? And $1 billion for Circuit City? We asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli where Blockbuster might go to come up with that kind of money.
Blockbuster's got less than $200 million in the bank and a valuation just north of $500 million. So how does it cough up more than $1 billion to buy Circuit City?
To finance a $1.4 billion deal, it's not there.
That's Michael Rudnick of the investment trade publication The Deal. He says given the lousy climate for borrowing money, Blockbuster intends to float a special stock offering to shareholders to pay for Circuit City. If they won't bite, Rudnick says board member Carl Icahn is waiting in the wings.
If they don't raise the money, he'll put up his own money.
Financing isn't the only tricky question. There's another key issue. Why would two companies with hundreds of millions of dollars in losses want to get hitched anyway? Eric Schoenfeld of TechCrunch.com says Blockbuster and Circuit City have both seen their businesses socked by the digital world.
This is just their attempt to try and salvage something out of their existing asset. But just because they can do it financially doesn't mean it makes sense strategically.
Unless you consider Blockbuster's raging case of Netflix and Apple envy, they've been beating Blockbuster at the entertainment delivery game. The notion is that teaming up with Circuit City might give Blockbuster an edge. So says analyst Stephen Baker of the NPD Group.
For Blockbuster, what I think it offers is opportunities to sell devices that enable people to access media in all sorts of different places.
And the two chains have got plenty of places. Their best asset? The 9,300 stores between them. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
I don't think the Dow moved more than 30 or 40 points up or down all day today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For those who think American stock markets are shaky, we've got just one word for you today, Shanghai. The benchmark Shanghai Composite Index tumbled 5.6% overnight. I'd point out that's its biggest drop in more than 2.5 months, but then you might miss the real story here, which is that 2 months is nothing. The index is off almost 35% so far this year. Since what goes around international stock markets tends eventually to come around, we've got Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line from Shanghai to talk things over with us. Hey, Scott.
Kai, how are you?
I'm good. Listen, last time we heard from you about the stock market over there, it was that nannies and cab drivers were getting into the stock market. In fact, I think your nanny was getting in, right?
Well, everybody was getting in, and our nanny and her sister were thinking about getting in, and thank goodness they didn't get in. because they would have got in at the peak last summer or so and lost a whole lot of money. The point is, there was just this frenzy. You couldn't go out in the street and not have a conversation with anybody about the stock market. And what was happening was you had basically all these retail investors who were just getting in, and they were speculators. They were playing the momentum of the stock market to kind of get in really quickly. In Chinese, trading stocks is the word for stir fry. So you get in and out really quickly and play momentum. Now, that momentum was great in 2006 when the market was up more than 100%, and last year when it was up more than 70%. But the momentum came quickly on the downside, and so now we're down more than 40% from the peak last year.
All right, so here's the tough question. What happened? Why is it down?
Well, a lot of people just decided to sell all at the same time, and that's part of what the pack investing has happened here in China. And a lot of investors, they're not particularly sophisticated. There was one poll, granted it was not a whole lot of people in this poll, but it found that 18% of retail investors knew what a price-to-earnings ratio was. So that's part one. The other part of it is a lot of what people buy and sell based on is what the government does or what they think the government is going to do. So what we had in China is a lot of talk of inflation starting from last fall and last winter, and the government had some of these tightening policies to limit bank lending and to raise interest rates, and all these things were these government interventions where people said, oh no, something is going to happen and we need to sell. Now, what's happening now is the government has been pretty silent as this market has been going down. So in the blogosphere, there are a lot of people saying, you know, oh, big brother, where art thou? Because you bailed us out before. Where are you now? This is the Olympics year, and everything is supposed to be stable, and the government is kind of missing here. And that's what people are talking about.
What about out on the streets, though, Scott? I mean, is there a sense of things being really dire?
You hear a lot of anecdotes of people being angry, of people losing their shirts. But if you think about the broader economy, it's not showing up in the numbers. Only a small percentage of Chinese nationals play the stock market compared to most other countries, including the United States. And if you look around China, they're still buying cars. They're still buying flat-screen televisions. Corporate earnings still look pretty good. So no sign that the stock market is kind of sending the Chinese economy over a cliff. I mean, we're still talking about growing maybe 9% this year.
What's the takeaway, though, for the American economy, just because, you know, these two countries are so closely intertwined? Are there worries that the fall over there could mean bad things over here on Wall Street?
Not the stock market. Of course, there's a lot of trade going on between the U.S. and China. But the Chinese stock market, where it trades in Shanghai and the southern city of Shenzhen, is subject to a lot of capital controls. It's pretty hard to bring a lot of hot money in and out of China. So those capital controls limit the effect of what happens in the Chinese stock market and the rest of the world. One economist said it's kind of like a different planet.
Marketplace's Scott Tong for us in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, Kai. Thank you.
Think about this for a second as you consider the joys of the U.S. tax code. Despite the up-and-down year that was Wall Street in 2007, mutual fund investors are going to be paying more in capital gains taxes tomorrow. How come, I hear you ask? Well, investors see the market fall, they sell out of their funds to stop the bleeding, and that's fine, but then they have to pay taxes on whatever gains they manage to hold on to. The tax code hasn't gotten much attention in the presidential debate so far, but commentator and business historian John Steele Gordon says proposals to raise capital gains taxes might not be too smart.
Both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama have called for an increase in the capital gains tax rate. It's currently at 15%, and they'd like to see 20 or even 25%. Have they really thought this through? Consider four things. First, the capital gains tax is usually thought of as a rich man's tax. After all, only capitalists have capital gains, right? That was mostly true in the 1930s, when capital gains were first treated differently from other kinds of income. It's not true today, when over half of American households own financial securities. The vast majority of capital gains taxpayers today are solidly middle class. In 2005, 47% of households paying capital gains taxes had incomes below $50,000. And 79%, almost 4 out of 5, had incomes under $100,000. Second, both senators have said an increase in capital gains taxes would increase federal revenues. But when the tax was raised in 1986 from 20 to 28%, tax receipts went down, not up. People just stopped realizing capital gains. When Bill Clinton signed a reduction in the tax rate into law in 1997, however, receipts soared. They soared again after 2003 when the tax was further cut to 15%. Capital gains tax receipts actually doubled in the next 3 years. Third, stock prices are determined by the market's best guess as to future earnings. If you raise the capital gains tax, you inescapably lower the possible future earnings on all stocks. So what happens? The market goes down. A capital gains tax hike is a perfect way to cause a bear market, or make one worse. Fourth, in a globalized economy, a capital gains tax increase would discourage investment in the U.S. from abroad, where capital gains taxes are often lower. Raising the capital gains tax is a classic example of what George Orwell called an idea so stupid only an intellectual could have conceived it.
Business historian John Steele Gordon's most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. Send us your thoughts. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, figuring out the tipping point online.
By delaying action until you know that you have all the pieces in place for the action to be successful and get the outcome that you desire, you're reducing the risk of acting as a group.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors took a breather today on Wall Street in a relatively quiet session. The Dow Industrial shaved off 0.1%, 23 points, to close at 12,302. The NASDAQ gave back 0.6%, 14 points, closed at 2275. The S&P 500 moved down 0.3%, 4 points, ended the day at 1328. Wachovia shares dropped more than 8% today on that news we told you about. That $1.3 billion offer from Blockbuster energized Circuit City quite a bit. Shares in the electronics retailer charged up 27%. Blockbuster didn't fare as well as usually happens in these kinds of deals. Its stock rewound more than 10%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.51%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Gather.com, where friends can stay in touch. People are talking at Gather.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for March. A Senate committee addresses the issue of drugs in the nation's drinking water. And Amnesty International publishes its global death penalty statistics for 2007. It looks at how many people were executed or sentenced to death around the world. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As I mentioned earlier, it's time to do your part for the greater good. Tomorrow is the 15th of April, if somehow it escaped your notice. The deadline in most cases is for state taxes as well as federal. Income and sales taxes are the state's two biggest revenue streams. And as they struggle to balance their budgets in a down economy, they're cracking down on a giant loophole. Congress has been dodging the issue, but states are now starting to crack down on internet retailers. California has been thinking about taxing music downloads. And come June, New York says it's going to start hitting up companies like Amazon. From New York, the city, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
New York's legislature approved a budget for nearly $122 billion last week, and it's already having trouble rustling up that cash. Nathaniel Trelease is an expert on taxation and e-commerce.
So when they see economic slowdown, they see their revenue shrinking, what they do is immediately turn to areas of enforcement that they hadn't emphasized in the past.
In a lot of states, that means hitting up internet retailers. Some already pay sales tax, and those that have no physical presence in the state don't have to. But New York is going after companies like Amazon by arguing they have partners with a physical presence in the state. By dollar value, Amazon is also the single biggest internet retailer doing business here. But it's a complicated issue. Retailers and customers alike obviously have reason to oppose the effort, and Trelease points out that the internet has really changed the nature of doing business.
Even if you're selling a product out of New York, you're selling into Colorado, you're selling into California and into Texas. Really, there are no borders.
But he says New York has no real jurisdiction to enforce the tax laws in those other states. Tom Bergen is spokesman for the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance.
Obviously, there's significant revenue out there if we could bring everybody in who's supposed to be in.
Bergen guesses New York will pull in an extra $100 million or so in the next fiscal year, not a lot compared with a budget of more than $100 billion. In any case, Amazon is expected to fight the ruling in court. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The gathering this weekend of high finance and macroeconomic types in Washington wasn't all about the credit squeeze and the dollar. The World Bank, in particular, made a point of talking about rising food prices and scarcity. In most places here in the U.S., there's plenty of food, but prices are getting everyday shoppers to be a bit more cost-conscious. So imagine what it's like, then, for people who have to buy for school hot lunch programs. Districts around the country have had to raise their prices. And Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. It's making it tougher to fill those cafeteria trays with healthy foods, too.
Francine Lupa provides healthy meals to 3,000 students in the Amherst, New Hampshire public schools. But she says that's getting harder all the time. Rising fuel costs, along with the increased cost of corn, used in everything from feed to ethanol, have pushed up the price of all foods.
Grapes were $18 to $20 a case, and the same case is $60 in the month of January and February.
Lupa says she's serving more canned peaches and applesauce now. She's also raised hot lunch prices and laid off two workers. Federal subsidies haven't kept up with food inflation, and school districts around the country are struggling to meet their healthy food goals, which often cost more. Many districts were just starting to give up the sloppy Joe and chicken nugget routine. Jim Weil heads up the Food Research and Action Center.
What's going to happen is schools are going to lose money, and the pushback against obesity is going to be weakened.
Some food service directors are back to selling high-profit snack items to stay in the black. Others are begging school boards to carve out funds from other parts of district budgets. But Mary Hill, president of the School Nutrition Association, says that's a hard sell.
They need funding as well to stay on top of purchasing books, paying teachers, those kinds of things.
Hill says her group will press the new Congress for a substantial hike in school meal subsidies. That would please food service directors like Lupa. She finally got multi-grain breads into her cafeterias, and she'd like to keep them there. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Live by the boycott, die by the boycott, if I could paraphrase just a little bit here. Some in China have started their own protests to counter threats of a boycott of the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. They want shoppers to boycott Chinese outlets of the French supermarket chain Carrefour over its perceived support of Tibet. And they're using the web and instant messaging to spread the word. Organizing effective boycotts, or anything that involves group behavior, isn't easy. Usually you have to get a critical mass of committed people before anybody wants to actually do anything. Gabriel Spitzer has this story of a company in Chicago and its fix for collective action.
Remember, I signed up for movie star quality.
This costs you 70 cents more.
Greg Rudin, COO of The Point, is just a few steps from his cubicle getting his hair cut. A bunch of Point employees needed haircuts, so they thought they'd bring a barber into the office. But barber Zoran Stepanov wasn't going to invest time in a house call unless he could count on a certain volume of business. Seven people agreed to go under the shears.
He did a phenomenal job. I might want a little bit more off the
top. You're kidding
me,
right?
That's why we actually wanted to make sure that we had enough to make it fully worth Zoran's while.
Point employees made it worth Zoran's while by applying their own model. Participants don't commit to anything unless a proposed transaction or activity reaches a certain tipping point of interested parties. In Zoran's case, the tipping point was seven customers. Company founders think that concept is a powerful tool for organizing collective action, whether a group purchase, a charity effort, or a demonstration. And they think by helping like-minded people form groups, advertisers will pay to target their messages to these groups. Venture capital firm New Enterprise Associates had enough confidence in the plan to invest nearly $5 million. Founder and CEO Andrew Mason says the points model has all kinds of applications.
By delaying action until you know that you have all the pieces in place for the action to be successful and get the outcome that you desire, you're reducing the risk of acting as a group.
People are using the point to buy heirloom chickens for poor women in Nicaragua and to organize a boycott of Pepsi. Another group wants to launch a giant inflatable banana into space above Texas. Trust me, they're dead serious. Or people can use the point to see if a business venture is viable. Founder Andrew Mason says the 90s band Cracker is using the point to see if it's worth playing a show in a small California town. They'll play if 150 people agree to come.
They want to know that the demand exists for them to go play that show before they're going to commit to doing something like that. So the campaign tipped, and now I think they're playing the show sometime in the next couple months.
It allows communities to emerge around very, very small phenomena.
Sean Safford teaches at the University of Chicago Business School. He says he's not sure the point would move many people to act who wouldn't otherwise.
What I think it might do is to take the people who would have acted anyway, and instead of wasting their time trying to find a community that's not going to go anywhere, switch your resources and your time and your effort to a movement that's going to have more impact.
This year we had turnip greens here. We had collard greens. We had mustard greens.
And next this year, is one area where the point could have an impact. Gene Carter Hill runs a community garden in one of Chicago's poorest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods.
That is our shed. The shed has been broken into three times, so we decided to try to get something more secured. So that's why the point is helping us out to get a steel shed.
Dozens of people have logged onto the point, entered their credit card information, and promised contributions, often just $10 or $25. If they reach $2,000, all the cards get charged, and Gene Carter Hill gets a shed.
I just hope we get to $2,000, because I don't know no other way we can get it.
Hey, Zoran. I'm ready.
What up, beautiful?
The best for the last, huh?
Yeah.
Back at the point, Andrew Mason is sliding into the barber chair. He says the company's not making money yet, but if enough people buy into their model, the business may soon tip into profitability. In Chicago, I'm Gabriel Spitzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to wrap things up today, we're always telling you retail spending is one of those economic indicators worth keeping an eye on, mostly because how much we're spending is directly related to how well the economy is doing, except when it's not. The Commerce Department reported March retail sales this morning, up a not-so-bad 0.2%. The not-so-good part is that all of that was due to higher gas prices. In that vein, the Energy Department said this afternoon gas was up more than a nickel last week, 5.7 cents to be exact. $3.39 a gallon is the national average now. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow tumbled 23 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 14 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 shimmied down 4 points. That's a 0.3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, video gamers turn their skills into cinema.
You learn all the tricks of the trade, but you learn them in a way that is not hindered by your lack of a budget. You can get all the experience of working on a real feature-length film now.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.